Hello and welcome back to The Fall of the Roman Empire. It's Nick Holmes and this is episode 80 called The Last Vandal King. In the last episode, we left Belisarius and his generals feasting in the Vandal Palace in Carthage, and Procopius wondered whether, in all of history, including that of ancient times, was there ever such a hero as Belisarius? Against all the odds, he'd crossed the sea and defeated numerically superior forces and recaptured Carthage, one of the greatest cities in the old Roman Empire, with negligible losses. So what now? Could he maintain this winning streak and complete the destruction of the Vandal kingdom? Well, the Vandal king Gelimer certainly hoped not. He'd retreated to the plain of Bulla, west of Carthage, to gather all the Vandal forces and counterattack. His brother Zazo had defeated the rebel Godas in Sardinia and returned with the Vandal fleet and the 7,000 troops he'd taken with him. Gelimer tried, largely in vain, to attract a wider coalition against the Romans, appealing to the powerful Berber tribes with whom he'd recently been in conflict, the Visigoths in Spain, and also the native African Roman inhabitants to come together and eject these Eastern Romans. But the response he got was very tepid indeed. The Berbers had little love for the Vandals and seemed to have been more inclined to view the Romans as the legitimate rulers of Carthage. They were more than happy to remain on the sidelines and see who won the contest. Meanwhile, the Visigoths had no interest whatsoever in getting involved in this war, and as for the native African Roman population, despite Gelimer offering a generous reward for every Roman soldier they killed, it was Belisarius who was winning the battle for their hearts and minds by stopping his troops from the usual looting and violence so typical of ancient and also modern armies. When he captured Carthage, he treated its inhabitants with great respect and successfully leveraged his trump card, the restoration of the Catholic faith at the expense of the Arian belief which the Vandals promoted. For example, he restored the Catholic priests to their historic positions and banished the Vandal-sponsored Arian clergy. Nowhere was this more apparent than in the main cathedral in Carthage, dedicated to a famous 3rd century African priest called Cyprian, which was restored to the Catholic faith, much to the approval of the city's population. Finally, Belisarius was also generous to the Vandals who stayed in the city and allowed them to stay there provided they accepted Roman rule. He also strengthened the city walls, which he found had fallen into disrepair in places. For 3 months, there was a sort of phony war, with Gelimer waiting for the return of Zazo from Sardinia and hoping that others would join his cause, while Belisarius watched the Vandal movements from the safety of Carthage. Finally, in late 533, Gelimer advanced on the city. But he didn't feel confident enough to besiege it, so he merely cut the main aqueduct. He then sent spies into the city offering the Huns money to swap sides, which might have met with success, according to Procopius, had Belisarius not become aware of it and lavishly entertained the Huns and promised them booty and a speedy ticket home should they defeat the Vandals. He also impaled one of the Roman inhabitants who was found liaising with the Vandals to set an example that he regarded such behaviour as treacherous. With Gelimer threatening but still not committing to an assault on the city, Belisarius forced the issue, and on the 15th of December 533 he led his army out of Carthage towards the Vandals, who were camped about 30 miles away near to a place called Tricamarum. The Roman advance guard camped for the night a short distance from the Vandals. It comprised the bulk of the armoured horse archers under the command of John the Armenian, who distinguished himself at the Battle of Adesimum by killing Amatus and routing his men, as we heard in the last episode. Meanwhile, Belisarius, proceeding more slowly with the infantry and 500 of his elite horsemen, camped a few miles behind. Belisarius also kept the Huns with him to keep an eye on them in case they switched sides. Procopius says this was distinctly possible since, despite Belisarius's attempts to win them over, they were waiting to see who would win the battle before joining the winning side. Procopius also narrates a strange omen that was seen in the Roman forward camp that night. Quote, "When it was well on in the night, the following prodigy occurred in the Roman camp. The tips of their spears shone with a bright fire, and their points seemed to be burning most vigorously. This was not seen by many, but it filled the few who did see it with anxiety, not knowing how it would turn out. This happened to the Romans in Italy, again at a much later time, but then they knew by experience that they could regard it as a sign of victory." End quote. The next day, Gelimer came out of his fortified camp with a vast host of horsemen and confronted the Roman horse archers. What followed is not described in great detail by Procopius, but seems to have involved the Roman cavalry making several sorties against the Vandals, each time showering them with arrows before galloping off in the typical Hunnic-style tactics of the new Roman army, which it was now expert in. The purpose was to demoralise the Vandals as their horsemen died in a storm of arrows and encourage them to charge in a disorderly fashion at the Romans. These tactics appear to have worked perfectly. The dispirited Vandals finally charged and battle was joined. John the Armenian led the main Roman assault, which broke the Vandal cavalry, killing Gelimer's brother Zazo, and in Procopius's words, quote, "many of the noblest Vandals fell." The Roman horsemen pushed the Vandals all the way back to their stockade. Procopius says only 50 Romans died, while the Vandals lost 800. Again, the question must be why the Roman casualties were so much lower than those of the Vandals. And the answer is the same as I suggested in the last episode at the Battle of Ad Decimum, that the Roman horse archers were simply far superior to the Vandal cavalry. Meanwhile, Belisarius reached the battlefield with the heavy infantry, the rest of the Roman horsemen and the Huns, ready to join the fray. But they weren't needed. At the sight of the massed ranks of infantry, Gelimer lost his nerve and retreated in panic. The entire Vandal army followed suit and fled the battlefield, taking as many of their women and children as they could. The Romans pursued them and cut many of them down. But it was the Vandal camp that stopped the Romans in their tracks. According to Procopius, quote, "they found in this camp a quantity of wealth such as never before been found, at least in one place. For the Vandals had plundered the Roman Empire for a long time and had transferred great amounts of money to Libya," as Procopius liked to call the Vandal kingdom. End quote. But it was not just gold and silver. They also found a huge number of Vandal women and children abandoned by their husbands. The women were, Procopius tells us, young and extremely attractive, and they proved far more effective at stopping the Roman army than their husbands had been. They quickly and efficiently decided en masse to offer themselves in marriage to the Roman soldiers, who, Procopius says, were almost all poor young men, overcome at the prospect of finding both wealth and attractive partners all at once. Discipline collapsed as the soldiers paired off with the women, with many of them even considering simply running away with their new girlfriends. Quote, "for neither did fear of the enemy nor respect for Belisarius occur to them, nor indeed anything else at all." End quote. Even Belisarius hadn't expected this and was, quote, "at a loss to know how to handle the situation." The next day, with his household troops, he closed the roads to stop mass desertions, took up a position on a hill, and restored some sort of discipline. Meanwhile, he sent John the Armenian with a group of soldiers to hunt Gelimer down. But they didn't get far, according to Procopius, because of a tragic accident. When they stopped for the night, one of John's best soldiers, Uliaris, a renowned horse archer but also a drinker, consumed too much wine, celebrating their victory over the Vandals, in which he'd played a brave and conspicuous part. When he was rebuked for being drunk, he jumped to his feet, saying even if he was drunk, he could still hit anything with his bow, and shot an arrow at a passing bird. Not only did he miss the bird, but the arrow hit John the Armenian in the neck. John died in Uliaris's arms, who was overcome with remorse for his foolishness. Before he died, John made his men swear they would tell Belisarius not to punish Uliaris, since it had been an accident and he hadn't meant to shoot him. When Belisarius caught up with them, according to Procopius, he wept over John's death, but reluctantly pardoned Uliaris out of respect for John's dying wishes. Another source says that from that day onwards, Uliaris was a changed man who gave up drink completely and became a monk. Meanwhile, Gelimer was in despair. The Vandal army had been shattered. A great number of the Vandal women and children were in Roman hands. The Vandal men had been scattered. But rather than surrender, Gelimer fled to find refuge with some friendly Berbers on an inaccessible peak on Mount Papua in Numidia. There, Belisarius had no choice but to starve him out, for no soldiers could ascend the peak without being killed. Finally, after a couple of months of extreme hardship, in March 534, he agreed to surrender. Procopius tells us Gelimer asked for only three things in captivity: a loaf of bread to assuage his extreme hunger, a sponge to bathe an infected eye, and a lyre to lament the fall of his kingdom. His poetical request for a lyre became famous, and although it sounds like a made-up story, there may be some truth in it, since he was apparently a skilled musician and harpist. Nevertheless, his wish to put the downfall of his kingdom to music raised doubts about his sanity, especially since when he met Belisarius, he burst into a fit of hysterical laughter, which his attendants explained was his response to the extreme vicissitudes of life. However, with his customary dignity, Belisarius reassured him he would be treated as befitted a king. So ended the reign of the last king of the Vandals. While Gelimer was starving on Mount Papua, Belisarius hadn't been idle. He mopped up the peripheral Vandal possessions around the western Mediterranean, occupying Sardinia, to which he sent Zazo's head as evidence of his victory, Corsica, the Balearic Islands, and the fortresses and towns around Gibraltar, and seizing Gelimer's royal treasury in Hippo Regius. His attempt to occupy the Vandal fortress at Lilybaeum in Sicily was, however, frustrated by the Ostrogoths, who claimed it for themselves. All in all, Belisarius's achievements were nothing short of astonishing. His destruction of the Vandal kingdom must be one of the greatest victories in Rome's entire history. It was not just militarily successful, but financially also, since the amount of captured Vandal treasure would have paid for the expedition many times over. John the Cappadocian was left to eat his words that the expedition would be financially ruinous, just as that of 468 had been. Justinian was completely vindicated. The moment he heard of the news of the capture of Carthage, he'd adopted the triumphal titles of Alanicus, Vandalicus, and Africanus. However, according to Procopius, Belisarius's success aroused jealousy and caused some of his officers to claim he was looking to set up his own kingdom in Africa. Nevertheless, Justinian, who often could be paranoid, on this occasion seems to have had complete confidence in his general, who'd brought him such success not only in conquering Africa, but also, of course, in quelling the Nika riots. He invited him to return to Constantinople to celebrate his own triumph, or if he preferred, to stay in Carthage while Gelimer and the main Vandal prisoners were paraded through the streets of Constantinople. Belisarius chose to return himself, perhaps to impress upon the emperor that the allegations of his treachery were unfounded. But he needn't have worried, for he found Justinian in an extremely grateful mood. Procopius explains he was the first general to be awarded his own triumphal parade since the days of the Republic over 600 years before. In the imperial era, it had always been emperors like Titus and Trajan who'd led the processions, and in any case, the dearth of Roman victories meant no parades had taken place for centuries. A procession of Vandal captives who were, quote, very tall and fair of body, was paraded through the streets, led by Gelimer and members of his family. Gelimer was allowed to wear purple garments to denote his rank. Throughout the proceedings, he was said to repeat over and over, vanity of vanities, all is vanity, taken from the Old Testament, supporting the view of those who thought he'd lost his mind. A huge amount of captured gold and silver was paraded after him, including treasures from the Temple of Solomon in Jerusalem, captured by the Emperor Titus some 450 years earlier. According to Procopius, when some Jews told Justinian that his victory was only because God wanted the Jewish treasures restored to Jerusalem, Justinian became fretful and, fearing some sort of divine retribution if he didn't take action, he sent them to Jerusalem to be stored in Christian sanctuaries to appease both Jews and Christians. Although the triumphal procession was in Belisarius's honour, Justinian ensured it was also an opportunity to make clear who was the boss. When Gelimer reached the hippodrome and was brought before Justinian, sitting in the imperial box, he was stripped of his royal clothes and prostrated before Justinian's feet. Belisarius himself also had to kneel before the emperor. But Justinian's delight with the victory was such that he allowed Gelimer to live the rest of his days with his family in comfort on an estate in Galatia, and he would apparently even have made him a patrician had he renounced his Arian faith, which he refused to do. As for Belisarius, the honours continued. On the 1st of January 535, he was made consul, the position which Justin had given Justinian himself before he became emperor, and he was allowed another triumph, this time borne aloft by Vandal captives, as he distributed some of the Vandal wealth to the people of the city. Perhaps this was a calculated measure to compensate for the slaughter he perpetrated on the city's population in the Nika riots. It was probably also a reflection of Justinian's genuine devotion to those who he regarded as his friends. For example, we know he was completely devoted and loyal to his wife Theodora throughout their lives, and although he would later feel threatened by Belisarius's success and popularity, at this stage he seems to have felt only warmth and gratitude to the man who transformed his rule, conjuring up such a breathtaking miracle to offset the dark days of the Nika riots. But there was also another completely unrelated reason for Justinian's good humour and generous mood. Just as the opportunity to intervene in the Vandal kingdom was occasioned by a succession problem when Hilderic had been ousted by his cousin Gelimer, so a similar opportunity was opening up in the much larger kingdom of the Ostrogoths. This kingdom, by far the most powerful of the barbarian successor states in Western Europe, had been created by Theodoric the Great, who, in his 33-year-long reign, had forged an empire encompassing the western half of the Balkans, the whole of Italy, southern France, and even Visigothic Spain at the end of his reign. But there was a problem. Theodoric was very unlucky with his succession planning. He had no male heirs and only one daughter, Amalasunta, with his Frankish wife, Ordafleda. When, for whatever reasons, his wife bore him no more children, since he couldn't divorce her for political reasons, she was, after all, the sister of the Frankish king Clovis, he turned to concubines, but they only bore him more daughters. Now an old man, and knowing time was running out, he found a husband, Eutharic, for Amalasunta, who could be his successor. Bad luck struck again. Eutharic died early, but there was one consolation. Before her husband died, Amalasunta gave birth to a boy named Athalaric, and she also had a daughter. Finally, Theodoric had a grandson to pass his kingdom to. However, the succession problems weren't over, since Athalaric was barely 10 years old when Theodoric died, age 72, in 526. This left Amalasunta as queen of the Ostrogoths and regent for her son. It wasn't an ideal situation for a society in which a king was expected to lead his warriors into battle. Nevertheless, for about 5 years, Amalasunta proved herself a ruthless and formidable ruler. She had the three nobles who most opposed her murdered, and she kept a ship loaded with treasure in Ravenna in case she needed to flee to Constantinople. This was when she negotiated the rapprochement with Justinian. But according to Procopius, matters came to a head when Amalasunta disclosed her now teenage son was learning to read and write, something which shocked the Gothic nobility, who believed a boy only needed to be taught how to use a sword and spear. Quote, "For letters," they said, "are far removed from manliness, and the teachings of old men result, for the most part, in a cowardly and submissive spirit," end quote. Amalasunta gave way to the nobles and allowed her son to be taken from his books to lead a more manly life, although Procopius says this actually consisted of nothing more than, quote, "drunkenness and sex with women." Indeed, he was led into a life of such debauchery that it resulted in his death in October 534, quote, "at a drunken party that had no limits," end quote. This was disastrous for Amalasunta. In desperation, she formed an alliance with a cousin of Theodoric's named Theodahad, declaring him king and announcing their joint rule. But secretly, she was preparing to flee to Constantinople. When Belisarius tried to take the Vandal fortress of Lilybaeum in Sicily, in public she protested, but in private she sent an urgent message to Justinian offering him the Ostrogothic kingdom if he would guarantee her a wealthy and safe retirement. But she never got there. In April 535, Amalasunta was found murdered in her bath. Suddenly, Justinian was confronted with a situation very similar to that which had proved so successful in Africa. A foreign kingdom, riven with internal conflict. A letter on his desk from a queen offering him her kingdom. Now, news of her murder. He had the perfect pretext to invade Italy if he wanted. In the spring of 535, we can imagine the sleepless emperor staring out of the palace windows late at night, and as he stared into the dark waters of the Bosphorus, he was probably considering his destiny. Would he be the one chosen by God to restore the Roman Empire? First, Africa. Next, the Eternal City itself? And that ends this episode. Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. And in the next episode, which will be in a week's time on the 16th of March, we'll continue with the extraordinary story of Justinian and Belisarius. And in the meantime, please do leave a review if you like the podcast, and do also check out my website, nickholmesauthor.com, link in the show notes to find maps, blogs, and a free ebook. And of course, do check out my latest book, Rome and Attila. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.